Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Reuben Stern. This week, a committee developing new Columbia Public School boundary lines will present its recommendation to the Board of Education. This follows almost a year of discussion that included more than 1,000 individual public comments. The boundaries dictate who goes to which school in Columbia and need to be reworked for the opening of Muriel Battle High School in 2013. The new boundaries also are needed to accommodate a changed structure for the school system that abandons separate middle and junior high schools in favor of intermediate schools catering to grades 6 through 8. In deciding on the new boundaries, the 22-member committee was looking to balance diversity and to minimize travel time for students. It also tried to take into account many other concerns raised by the public. So, how did the committee do? How well does the final recommendation meet those challenges? What sort of trade-offs had to be made? And how might the new school boundaries affect Columbia overall? Our panelists today can help answer these and many other school-related questions. First, Chris Belcher is the superintendent of the Columbia Public School District. Welcome back to our program, Chris Belcher.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Glad to have you back with us. Also with us, Jan Meese has been a member of the Columbia School Board since 2007. She was one of two school board members on the committee to redraw the school boundaries. Welcome to our program, Jan Meese.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us
as
well.
Glad to be here.
And our third guest is no stranger to our program. Darren Priest is one of the co-chairs of the committee working on the new boundaries. He is also the executive director of Central Missouri Community Action. Welcome to the program, Darren Priest.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us as well. We hope that you and our audience will also take part in our discussion today. What questions or concerns do you have about the new boundaries for Columbia's public schools? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's start with this question. Darren, maybe we'll start with you and work around the table here. What was the biggest concern that you heard from parents throughout this process?
I have to start by giving a shout-out to Don Ludwig. He was the co-chair of this committee as well and put in a tremendous amount of hours. I was more moral support along the way, I think, because he was really the one that was working with our consultant and dealing with the data and just put in an incredible amount of work and did a phenomenal job through the process.
Yeah, he unfortunately wasn't able to join us for the conversation
right,
today
absolutely.
Either.
And he apologizes. But so one of the things we really wanted to focus on was I think as we established guiding principles at the very beginning, the primary things that we heard, the top priorities were balancing demographics in terms of free and reduced lunch and diversity in general. And then also just kind of travel time and safety issues with some high school students that will be driving, and just in general for parents to be able to get their kids to school in the quickest and safest way possible.
And were there other concerns that seemed to be widespread throughout this process, or were those pretty much it?
I think you could honestly say that change is not an easy thing for people to take under consideration. And some of the parents felt that the changes might be too radical for what their students were used to or what they had intended when they moved into a particular house that I would go to this school and then this school. And so keeping with friends and cohorts was a concern for parents that they thought would negatively affect their children. And that was definitely something that was taken into account with a number of these scenarios that we did work out. And cohort idea.
And so now it's down to a plan that's going to get presented to the school board, right?
Yes.
And what are some of the biggest...
Two different plans, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Okay. And what are some of the biggest challenges or changes that are going on with those plans that people would notice if they hadn't studied them carefully?
Well, I can weigh in there. I've sat back and let the committee process work. I did not want to be seen as unduly influencing the situation. But when it came down to Plan B... From the educational standpoint, I like it because the two middle schools feed into a high school, so we'll have three separate cohorts of secondary structures, which will be great for sharing personnel, setting tone, having interaction with students, etc. that's going to make it like having three smaller districts to manage at the secondary level.
So basically, when a student goes into that intermediate school, those kids are going to follow them all the way through the end of high school.
Yes.
Right.
Under this scenario.
And educationally, that's the best structure. And as we talked about prior to the show, any three of those as a superintendent I could live with, because we're going to provide high-quality curriculum, good instruction. It's going to be the same teachers. We're just scrambling the teachers we have. That's not going to be the issue. So I'm comfortable with any of the three that we presented, but this one makes the best educational sense for resource management.
Mm-hmm. And that's not even really something that was a priority as we went into the process. It's something that through the process, by the mechanisms we use in the planning process, that sort of evolved as a way to really support the educational aspects of the attendance areas. And so it was sort of an unintended benefit through the whole process.
And that's also where the cohort idea that parents tossed at us at some forums to say, my kids would like to be with their friends. Well, from middle school on, they know that they will have that comfort level. And that's a real fragile time for kids when they're teenagers, adolescents, so that having that continuity to them is good emotionally as well as the academics, which is high on the list of importance.
Mm-hmm. Were there other concerns that were difficult to try to work into any of the plans that maybe were not able to be addressed, but for whatever reason,
that the school board is going to really probably struggle with next is transfer policies. So we've created an entire new structure, and this was an enormous endeavor to go after, not only adding a third comprehensive high school, but at the same time changing the whole process of going from middle and junior high schools to intermediate schools into high school. So it was an enormous process. And I think that there will be parents that want to be given an exemption or a waiver or preference in terms of sticking with the high school that they thought they were going to be going to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be something the board really has to struggle with. I think that the committee did a phenomenal job in coming up with the best scenario for the most kids. But there are going to be individual families that still feel like, they're right close to a border, or, they've had three kids go through one high school and they really want that fourth one to go through because they're only a year away from it. There's going to be some situations where I think the school district might want to consider those situations. Maybe not, but I think that'll be the next thing that the board has to struggle with.
It's hard to know if there'll be a black and white right answer for that transfer. I know that our secondary superintendent has had conversations with other school districts in the state similar to ours that have opened new high schools and had redistricting going on and what kind of transfer policies were enacted. In addition, Don did a lot of work with numbers so that the board and the committee and the board would see the physical impact enrollment-wise if you let a huge cohort move on or stay at a school. And those are very critical numbers for the board to consider when we come down to deciding on the transfer policies.
Okay. I want to come right back to the transfer policy. First, I just need to remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about new school boundary lines in Columbia. Joining me in the studio are Superintendent Chris Belcher, School Board Member Jan Meese, and co-chair of the Boundary Committee, Darren Priest. For those of you in our audience, how much do you think diversity should be a factor when deciding on boundaries for schools? And what other goals do you think should be taken into consideration? Share your thoughts. You can give us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. If you have questions for our panelists, feel free to call in with those as well. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA, and it's also online at kbia.org. You can watch our live video stream. You can also join our live online chat at that time by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. Chris Belcher, the transfer policy, you were about to weigh in there.
Well, Columbia was sort of an exception to the rule. When I came here, the transfer policies at both the elementary and the high school are rather loose. And although that makes sense a lot of times when you talk about giving choice, what it does, it also creates opportunities for manipulation and inequity. And as we go to three high schools, to allow so much options would sort of undermine the efforts of all the boundary work. Mm-hmm. And so what I will present to the board in about 10 days is a much more restrictive transfer policy that says you're assigned to a certain area that's where you go unless there's a legitimate educational, medical, safety need that we should, of course, make some decisions on. And we're going to get our schedules to be about the same at the high school, so that doesn't become an issue. And, of course, as superintendent of schools, my position is going to be that we'll have 3 high schools and 6 middle schools, and they will all have the same curriculum and good quality teachers. They'll have their own little personalities, but they will essentially be delivering the same issue. Parents need to know, I think, is that's the way it's done in most communities. As we did our research, that's the way it is. It's not always popular, but when you go the other way, you create additional problems that can get in the issue of why does one student get to choose over the other, and are we discriminating based on some parent's influence or political base or position in the community, and that's just not fair all the way around.
Mm-hmm. Darren, you agree with that, a strict transfer policy?
Personally, I would like to ease into a stricter policy, and that's my personal opinion. The committee, I think, has left that wide open for the board and the administration to come up with some recommendations. We had talked about throughout the course of this process, the possibility of having a sort of a transition year or two where policies might be looser, and that's what I was talking about. The board will struggle, I think, because I suspect that they'll get a lot of feedback from the community that doesn't support Dr. Belcher's recommendation in this case. I think from a curricular and from a administration and from just a business perspective, it makes very good sense to have a very tight transfer policy and don't allow transfers. As a parent, I feel like, parent choice is a good idea, and those are the things that the district is going to have to weigh.
It's going to be a tough balance.
Jan Meese, do you have thoughts on this at this point?
I have thoughts that I would like it to be black and white because that would make it easier on everyone to know where they stand. But like Dr. Belcher says, there are going to be individual instances. But the emotional part of this has to almost be eliminated, if at all possible.
I do think that we need to, consider what are the underlying reasons that people want transfers.
Yeah.
And too often it has to do with, their friends or with sports. And both of those are very good emotional reasons, but not necessarily from a school district perspective to have to take into consideration. And one of the things I talked a lot about over the last, year or so as we've been working on this is that so many more kids are going to have opportunities to be involved in varsity athletics with mm-hmm. a third comprehensive high school. So I think that that's an exciting opportunity regardless of which high school a kid ends up at. And that's something that I think people haven't really embraced that in their heads because this is, again, such a tremendous change to have a whole new school with 1,500 kids right off the bat in that first year. But I think it's going to be really exciting to have a whole new avenue for sports, music, drama, all of the extracurricular activities that go on in high school.
Statistically, we should get over 30% more participation simply because we're giving more opportunity. Mm-hmm. Because when you go from 2 large high schools to 3 still large high schools, you're going to get a lot more options for kids to get involved. I'll take a little personal experience as we search the areas and looking at transfers. Of course, we talked to Liberty, who has just built a new high school, and I have my wife's sister lives there, and I drove up there on Christmas, and in the front yard was a Blue Jay and an Eagle from each high school, and the senior was at Liberty High School, and the 2 younger kids were at Liberty North, and they were split. They were freshmen and sophomores, mm-hmm. so they looped up into that program, and I said, well, how is that? And the kids, oh, that's fine. It just wasn't an issue to the students. Now, that's not always the case. There certainly will be students that have issues. But the reality is my experience in Blue Springs, when we went from Blue Springs, one high school, to Blue Springs South, the drama around the parents was much greater than the drama with the students. Mm-hmm. And we opened that school, and the students had already established it as their school. They had preseason band and football and summer activities, and they'd always competed against each other in the summer in athletics anyway. It wasn't abnormal to compete against a friend.
Right.
In the athletic fields.
How is this going to play out? I mean, is it going to all at once from one spring into the fall switch and the students would go to different schools, or is it a gradual phase in? What's the logistics of that?
Fall of 2013, when we open school, everybody will go to their newly assigned school.
Except for the seniors.
The seniors get to stay at Hickman or Rockbridge.
And that would trickle all the way down to the elementary school level?
Elementary is not affected in this. They're staying where they are at this point.
So those are not getting changed at all at the elementary school level?
Not at this point.
Okay.
Now, we are planning on opening a new elementary school in 2015 up on the property where Battle High School is, so that area of the community will be redistricted elementary-wise, but that's That's not the charge for this committee. And I want to comment one more time on the transfer policy. When there were only two high schools, Hickman and Rockbridge, and they theoretically had different – they did have different scheduling. And a lot of parents would choose one because it was a traditional schedule versus a block schedule. And now as we move to the three high schools, I have a feeling that the scheduling will be very similar at all, as Hickman is going to a modified block and Rockbridge will maintain their block. I therefore would guess that – that was one of the main reasons that parents would use to do transfers.
And the idea of sticking with friends from a lower school, this plan of cohort moving through the schools together ideally would eliminate that desire.
Yes.
Right.
And we had some comments early on in the discussion about trying to have a cohort from elementary schools going into middle school, and that was first impossible when you have 19 small elementary boundaries to get those to fit just wouldn't work. Yeah. And two, from the developmental standpoint of children, they don't form those same bonds that they do in the middle school. Most of us can think of when we went to high school, we were still those close friends with the kids we had in elementary school because we were often isolated to one classroom of 25 kids. So it's not as emotionally pivotal, I don't think, at that point. And we have not heard a lot of that from the parents. It's mainly been the secondary cohorting up. And again, as Darren mentioned, that was not the intent, but as it came out and worked through, I found myself drawn to Plan B simply because of the educational connections that would allow for us to deal with.
And I wanted to comment, too, on your question about the start date. While we do know that the first day of class, 2013, all of this will be in place and the new system will be there, part of the reason that the committee worked so much in advance is because, you know, in February the board will make a decision about the new attendance areas, and from that point forward the administration is putting all of the pieces in place, so parents will know what they can expect a year in advance. The new high school principal has been identified. They're going to be working to identify the band teacher and the football coach, and you know, a lot of the kind of key leadership, community leadership positions for the Battle High School. So it's not that it will be just like a, you know, tomorrow is when it all starts.
Right.
It will be transitioned in so that the kids and the parents that are part of that community will start to embrace the new feeling of Battle High and get to know some of the key staff positions and leadership positions. And I think that everybody's going to really kind of coalesce around the new structure and have lots of time to absorb it and get used to it and really start to feel like it's their own.
We have a question emailed in that sort of looks at it from the opposite way in terms of looking ahead and trying to get ahead of the curve on these changes. Marilyn emailed in this question. Will a current ninth grade student who is in the Rockbridge High School under the old boundaries but in Hickman under the new ones be able to transfer to Hickman in the fall of 2012 instead of waiting until 2013 so that they can have continuity and be in the same high school for all of that time?
Absolutely. We have promised that. We're working it into policy. We don't think it's fair to ask a child to make two changes in 2 years if they can plan ahead. So we will have a plan in place that if a student notifies us, I think we put May 1st in the first draft of the policy, by May 1st of this year, that they will be able to do that. And as Darren expressed, once we vote on these, hopefully in February, which is sort of my drop-dead date, we will send a letter out to every one of those students saying you are identified to go to X school in 2013. You have the option to go ahead and transfer and start at that school this year, if it's Rockbridge or Hickman type of a model. We'll be able to identify every child and where they're going and personalize the communication to them and their families and where they're going to go and allow that a lot of time to get used to. And then in addition, next year we've planned into our schedule a lot of times for our professional development days that the teachers at the secondary level will drive to the school they're going to be assigned for the following year and do that community building and planning that they need to start up the school the following year. We've done this very well. The boundary work has been done with an exceptional level, and the planning is being done to exceptional level. And we may drop the ball on the little things, but I think we're thinking very globally about the big pictures and the way we need to communicate personally, individually with parents and students, not just through policy and web page postings and those kind of things.
Okay. Reminder to our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about new school boundary lines in Columbia. Joining me in the studio are Superintendent Chris Belcher, School Board Member Jan Meese, and Co-Chair of the Boundary Committee, Darren Priest. For those of you in our audience, Are you the parent of a school-aged child? If so, do you have specific concerns related to the boundary redrawing in Columbia? If so, feel free to give us a call, and our panelists can take a crack at answering your question. Our phone number is 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. In terms of the high schools, we've talked a lot about the high school boundaries. What are some of the major changes in terms of areas of town where students used to go to one high school, they're going to go to another? How is that shaking out in terms of those boundaries? That was particularly challenging, right?
Right, and I would say pretty much everything east of Highway 63 is going to be different because they were either going to Hickman or Rockbridge. Well, in every case, they were either going to Hickman or Rockbridge.
Or if you're going to Douglas, I suppose.
Sure, sure, yeah. Of course. But for Battle High School, you know, if you sort of picture the city as a pie chart, you have, for the most part, everything east of Highway 63 is going to go to Battle High School. And that's a pretty significant change. But it really makes sense. When you look at a map, it just makes sense to divide it that way. 63 is a nice kind of natural dividing line. And that's going to be the thing that's the most striking, whereas previously it was really a north-south division. You're going to see a lot of east-west division along with a little bit of north-south with Rockbridge and High School and Hickman.
Help me with my numbers here if I can remember correctly, though. But I think this impacts more the students at Hickman than the Rockbridge students, just because of the geography of the school placement. More students will be moving from Hickman percentage-wise than from Rockbridge percentage-wise to Battle.
And if you – yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So if you sort of use Highway 70 and Highway 63 as the crosshairs and you think about like that southeast corner – many of them went to Rockbridge in the past, but it's not really
dense.
That many students
in that
quadrant. Whereas in the Northeast, there are many, many more. They would have been going to Hickman in the past, and now they'll be going to Battle.
And Hickman was the larger school population, and so some of that's just because of the numbers.
Yeah. What about the balancing of the makeup of the reduced price lunch was one of the metrics that was being used trying to balance that out, and putting that against the geography of the situation, because the I mean, that's a trade-off there that had to be made in order
and
to make this
impossible.
Work, right?
They got close to some
nice
things
to
and closer
that, yeah.
to. And we mentioned we would try to look at that at all costs. But the reality of how the developments have occurred in town and where people have chosen to live is just there. And the public was very clear in telling us they didn't want us to do anything crazy to make that happen. They didn't want to have contorted and little islands. And the only way you could do it was by contorting and have little islands. So,
and we did have a scenario with a little island that was going to take some folks down to Rockbridge, and that really did not go well with the committee.
One of the first of the 150 maps or so that we came up with was we strictly took free and reduced lunch, and we use that as kind of a proxy for diversity. It's about as close as you're going to come as far as a data point. But we basically told the consultants, RSP, to divide up the schools equally. So there's equal free and reduced lunch at each of the high schools, and it was just crazy. I mean, it looked like an Rorschach painting, and you just threw numbers on the wall and saw where they stick. It clearly didn't make sense from a transportation perspective, and there's just no way we could justify that. So we didn't even use that to start. We went back to where the boundaries were prior to the whole process and started to move lines to see how that would affect the free and reduced lunch and still make sense in terms of transportation. And I just want to say that it's critically important to at least try to have some equity in terms of free and reduced lunch, not so much because of the resources in the schools. I mean, we know that the schools are fantastic, and they've got great teachers, and they're being redistributed according to the new intermediate and high school structure. We know that's all there. But there are some challenges that parents face who are struggling economically, and their ability to support the school and to support their child. And so the more equity you can have in the schools when it comes to that, the better. That's not to say that completely equal division is necessary, because as Dr. Belcher said, you know, the school district will make sure the resources are there to meet the needs of the students.
And how are the numbers shaking out across the three schools?
Relatively balanced. I think, you know, they weren't as close as the closest scenario, but we came up, I think maybe 48% is the high at Battle High School, and then 34 or 5 at Rockbridge High School, and then around 36 or 8.
I think it's in the 20s.
I think it's in the 20s as well down at Rockbridge.
20s at Rockbridge,
right?
Yeah. But within
and that's
10
the percentage of students who would be
who are eligible,
who qualified
eligible
for free and reduced lunch. Okay. We know now qualified for free.
That's right. We are due new numbers from our consulting firm.
We'll have
soon.
Those tonight.
Oh, I'm excited to
but
see
But I want to add one thing here. The Lake Wobegon effect. I had at one parent function, they say, well, this is ridiculous. No high school should be above 40% poverty. And I said, our district average is 43%. We can't have everything below what the average is. So to have 48 at one and, say, 24 at another is not as large of a gap as people think it is, because our average is 43. And so we're going to have some of that. But the point educationally I want to make is certainly schools that have a higher free and reduced lunch are going to generally have lower composite test scores. Not because of the vocabulary, the number of books at home. There's all sorts of characteristics around poverty that impact that. But that doesn't mean if I go to a school and I'm motivated and college-oriented and have parents that support that, that because I go to school with more kids from poverty, that's going to impact my quality of instruction. I think people sometimes sort of have a belief that that's somehow going to impact my child. Matter of fact, we know that more diverse environments often are beneficial to children and allow them to experience and have conversations with people different than themselves that help them grow and expand in a complicated world. So a lot of times everyone thinks that this is the end all of what's going to happen, and it is an indicator, but we're still going to have high-quality AP programs at every school. We're going to have ACT prep. We're going to have college-bound programs. We're going to have career education. It's going to be the same program and opportunities available for all kids.
Now, I don't want to paint too pretty a picture of that, and I totally agree with everything Dr. Belcher just said, but at the same time, there's 43% of our community is eligible for free and reduced lunch. That means that they have income up to 185% of poverty. And at 185% of poverty, you're just barely able to meet the basic needs of your family. That is a problem. It's a community problem, though. It's not a school problem, and it's not something that the attendance area is going to fix. And I think that the school district has done a great job with the World Cafes that they've been conducting over the last 6 months or so, or maybe more than that, and reaching out to the community and looking for solutions to that. But it's not a attendance area issue. It is a community issue that we need to be addressing. We need to be looking for ways to support kids and economic stability across the community, because one of the ways that economic instability rears its head is through mobility. When families have less income, they're more likely to move during the course of a given year, and that makes it hard for any kind of planning in terms of attendance area, because you thought there was a family here, and they're actually over here by the end of the year. It also is difficult from an academic perspective, because you got a break in that student's learning. So it is a challenge. I am constantly impressed with the school district and the resources and the quality of instruction and everything that goes along with that. But we do have an issue in this community, as we do across the state of Missouri and across the country, and that is that poverty is real, and we can't sweep it under the carpet.
Sounds like a whole other show for you.
I've been on for that.
I bet
that's
you
right.
Have.
We have talked about
Aaron's
that.
Aaron's expert on that, absolutely. Yeah. But I will tell you, it's even more pronounced at the elementary, where you have smaller boundaries, and the movement then is more likely to get you out of a zone, whereas high school at least will be three broad boundaries, and maybe we won't have that as much, but in some of our low-income elementary schools, Reuben, we'll have as many as 35% of the kids change from August
to May. I wondered what the mobility rate was. Yeah.
And sometimes it's gone as high as 40, 42%. So almost one in two children will be different in the classroom from the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. And that is difficult, because with the low-income population, that establishment of relationships and trust between the families and the school is so important to getting that student to have progress. And every time you interrupt that, it's another strike against that student being able to get in and get the support they need.
Right.
This
is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about new school boundary lines in Columbia. Joining me in the studio, Superintendent Chris Belcher, school board member Jan Meese, and co-chair of the Boundary Committee, Darren Priest. We'll be back after a short break. Stick around. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about new school boundary lines in Columbia. Joining me in the studio are Superintendent Chris Belcher, school board member Jan Mees, and co-chair of the committee working on the boundary proposals, Darren Priest. For those of you in our audience, what questions or concerns do you have about the changes to the school boundaries in Columbia? Share your thoughts or ask your questions by giving us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We were talking a little bit during the break about the process that went into this. It's been going on for a year at this point.
Right.
22 people trying to sort this out, more than 1,000 comments from the public. How did you make all this work? How did you get to this one set of maps that you're now proposing to the school board?
It was a pretty ingenious process. I wish I could take credit for it, but again, Don Ludwig really, he worked closely with Dr. Wanda Brown, and they came up with a structure that I think worked quite well. We started by just coming up with some guiding principles, what's important to us, and we talked about that in the last half hour. And then the committee broke up into three different subgroups. The first committee was working to just keep elementary school cohorts together and move them up through the intermediate schools and into the high school. As Dr. Belcher said earlier, that scenario fell apart quickly because the size variation in the elementary schools is pretty dramatic, where you've got 700 kids in a Mill Creek Elementary and only 200 at a
Cedar Ridge.
So that was very difficult. The second committee was focused on just the intermediate schools. How do we keep the intermediate school cohorts together and put them up through the high school? And as you've heard, that's the scenario that really ended up working the best. And then the third subcommittee was starting with the high school, just how do we make good boundaries for the high schools, balancing transportation and free and reduced lunch types of considerations. And then so we worked all through the summer on the three different perspectives, and then in the fall, each of the committees presented to the large group, and we started to pick those apart and really look for where our preferences were, and we tweaked those a little bit, and then we took them out to the community, and that's when we had over 1,000 comments that came in online and through the public forums. And we saw some pretty common themes, I think, that came out of those. People either loved or hated the intermediate and high school A and C models, so they felt strongly about them, and we got relatively equal comments from people that loved it or hated it, whereas B kind of was sliding under the radar. People understood the process. Most people really liked the intermediate school cohorts staying together through the process. And then we got some really nice feedback in terms of just people really put some good thought into their comments, and we were able to embrace some of those ideas and tweak the map a little bit further. And then the committee was able to come to consensus in recommending Plan B to the board tonight.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that, Jan?
I was on Group A, and it was like pulling your hair out. And our intermediate one kind of got bashed right off the beginning, and you thought, I can't take this personal. We're doing this. This is for the best for our community. And I think it was a very iterative process, as Don keeps saying, and it seemed to have worked well. You can't imagine that you'd take a neighborhood and you go, can we put him here, and what will that do? And we looked at 1,500 planning areas within the community. I think the number is, a group of homes that's in planning area. And they were like checkers on a checkerboard. It was an incredible process.
I think what caught my eye was I guess it was humorous, that on any scenario you'd have X percentage that just hated it because of this and X percentage that loved it because of that.
Mm-hmm. For the same exact
reason. It was balanced.
So there is a balanced discord that was going to happen no matter what we did. And that's okay. I think we're down to the point where the logical assumptions and the process is appreciated. Now we're down to people that just have preference issues, that they don't like this school over that school. And certainly they can find a logical reason why it doesn't make sense that I have to go 3 miles to this school instead of 1 mile to this school. But when you have schools that over time pop up in odd ways to where Lang and Oakland are a mile apart, there will be some illogical issues on individual issues. From the broad picture, it's not illogical, but when you're one of those people who live on the street that the person across the street goes to one school and you go to another, they'll want to make that an issue, but yet that will be everywhere. Mm-hmm. If you move that, then it's just someone else that lives across the street. So those are the things we're getting to now. The board members are getting emails from patrons that have very specific issues, and it usually is about travel time and where they want their child to go. If they bought their house because they thought their child would go to this school, But as we know, we had the first bond issue passed for this high school in 2007, and people knew then that at some point when the high school was complete, there was going to be a big shuffle about the boundaries. So you can never assume in a large growing district like we are that boundaries are a given, because they will shift according to the way that the population ebbs and flows in a community.
Go ahead, Darren.
Well, I was just going to say, in the last decade, the city has grown so fast. You know, if the administration could have planned in the 50s for the size that the district is now, maybe we would have had a chance at, you know, really having the kind of equity that we were shooting for in the beginning. But the city is growing at leaps and bounds, and it's not growing necessarily in the directions that we all thought it was initially. Mm-hmm. And that's both exciting and challenging from anybody that's trying to plan for you know, what the next decade is going to look like. And that created a lot of challenges.
Yeah, it is quite remarkable when you look at the map and see how many schools are clustered in the mm-hmm. central part mm-hmm. of the city,
right.
even though they're serving
right.
far outlying areas.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I wonder about is, Dr. Belcher, you mentioned, you know, parents talking about my kid was supposed to go to this school and now that's changing, or the kid across the street. How much of what you heard from the public was that sort of thing, as opposed to these other issues like diversity that we've been talking about? How concerned was the public about that diverse makeup of the schools?
Honestly, the discussion was more about individual mm-hmm. preference. The diversity issue was brought up early on as a broad discussion. Mm-hmm. But as we've narrowed it down, that discussion has become less and less of a position, I think, that
right.
people bring to our attention.
And because it's now specific to a specific family, and they can say, oh, forget all the other stuff. This is me, and I want what I want versus what is for the greater good. And one thing that – a term that's come up a lot is resilience of our students. And I credit a fine teaching staff that we have that is going to make these transitions and understand what these kids are coming in with their whatever kind of examples of that they're you know, afraid to get into a new situation. And I think that the preparation time that we have now prior to that, I think we will be surprised at how easily this is going to flow for the kids.
I hope.
Yeah. The committee really, as we went into the public forums, we really had to just look at themes. We know that people are very, you know, passionate about their kids and where they're going to go to school and all the things that are around their kids. But we could listen to their comments for the themes that were that, you know, underline anything that they had to say. And I think that we were able to pull those themes out.
Oh, absolutely.
It was diversity in the schools was one of them. Transportation was the other of them. And then just having a structure that makes sense. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at the maps that we came up with in Plan B and say, oh, I can understand that. It makes sense. That's what we heard over and over, you know, that people, it may not suit them exactly and perfectly, but if they understand the process and they understand how we came up with this particular recommendation, I think that truly the vast majority of the community is going to be okay with our recommendation.
And we worked hard not to do this in a vacuum, not to do this behind closed doors as much as people might have thought. It was as open a process as we could have gotten, even down to the city and the county working with us about development issues and road issues, which I think is a very important component of this whole thing too, you know.
Well, let's talk about that. What was the interaction with city commissions, boards, other entities, county-level authorities? I mean, what was the input that went on there?
Well, it started very early when Dr. Ritter in 2008 chaired the committee to find the site. We had county planning people on that board. We had city planners and a various group of individuals that made that decision. And then when we put the boundary committee together, we made sure that there was a city planner. He came and updated the whole committee on various road constructions the next 10 years. We had people from the county that played that same role and talked about the growth areas and those things. We had our demographer that would come in and talk about the growth over time. We had the county assessor fully involved in the discussions and about those things. So I always tease people, if you come to one of these board meetings and ask the committee, did you think of, you don't have
you
to finish the question. The answer is yes.
We tried that.
I mean,
wasn't
we went
work,
through
yeah.
almost 200 specific scenarios, and we were briefed on all sorts of issues as much as you can. But as Darren said, in 5 years, we really don't know what the development's going to look like. Mm-hmm. Just, for example, we built the high school in 2006 and made decisions. It would be really different because once the recession came and the housing market slumped, mm-hmm. all your projections were null and void. Mm-hmm. So I've almost taken the Zen philosophy in that I think our biggest concern right now is parents convincing themselves that they know the consequence of the new boundary lines. And if they think that consequence is going to be overly negative, it may become self-fulfilled. But if they think the consequence is, you know, it's a school, it's good teachers, my kid's going to go there and connect and make friends, and it's going to be a positive experience, it probably will.
Mm-hmm. Do you all have a sense of how many kids we're talking about are going to be shifting to a different school from where they would have otherwise been going in the fall of 2013?
We have them by grade mm-hmm. and school, but it's kind of complex.
But in terms of overall, I mean, as a ballpark percentage of the students that might be looking at something like that?
Yeah, 300 or 400 that are
from one high school to another.
So at the high school level, 300 or 400, mm-hmm. somewhere in that ballpark?
Yes, that's sort of hard to answer because we're going to allow seniors to stay, so that group doesn't get affected, mm-hmm. and so it sort of phases in. But ultimately, at some point, when Battle fills out to about 1,600 students, that's 1,600 students that are at Battle High School that aren't at another school. But the Rockbridge to Hickman shift, because of the way we're phasing it in, is of actual kids that would have been at Rockbridge but go to Hickman or vice versa, is going to be somewhat small mm-hmm. because then they'll be starting their freshman year, and then that's their school.
Right.
So you won't see a great change at Rockbridge. You'll see more of a change at Hickman, but you'll see the greatest change of Hickman kids going to Battle.
Mm-hmm. And Battle is – oh, go ahead.
One of the things we got out of the November forums, too, it was really that people thought that Hickman was – we were overcrowding mm-hmm. Hickman, partly because of the issue with seniors and letting them stay, giving them some more flexibility in which school they went to. But we listened to that, and we changed that considerably. We took about 100 out of Hickman right. and moved not quite 100 into – Rockbridge, still under capacity for the school, but it eased up the attendance of Hickman a little bit to really in direct response to the feedback we got.
And each of the schools has different capacities of numbers mm-hmm. of students that they can handle. So that may be a discrepancy that people wonder about, but it's because the physical structure of the school can't handle more than 2,200 or 1,800 or whatever the particular number was.
And when the new high school opens in 2013, is it going to have all the grades in it, or is that going to gradually phase in over
all but the
time?
Seniors?
9 through 11.
And
yes.
then the following year they would matriculate up.
Initially, back in 2006,
yeah, this is why
or 7,
I was confused.
We were going to have a gradual build. We were going to do 3 bond issues of $60 million each to start the high school, then the next phase and the final phase. And that would have been quite an – it was – a good plan to try and show to our patrons that we were using their tax dollars wisely, but academically it was not good for students to be hither, thither, and yon. And they would have probably had to change schools more times than they are now. So,
and I think there were some political issues, you know, involved in that decision. I was on the board at the time that we you know, selected to have the 3 bond mm-hmm. issues. And I, you know, looking back on my brief career on the school board, that's a decision I probably wouldn't have made again. But the reality was, you know, what are the chances of getting a $200 million bond out there as opposed to a $60 million bond? It was a political reality that you had to do something differently. And, you know, I totally understand all the dynamics of why we made that decision at the time. But I am very, very pleased that Dr. Ritter came in and said, let's take another look at this and see if we can't get it all done at once, because it would have been just nightmarish trying to phase in a grade at a time into the, you know, the literal physical building as it expanded a grade at a time as well. So that would have been tough.
And not to mention we saved $25 million on that change in decision, along with the economy mm-hmm. slowing down, so we got more competitive bids. But you know, I took this job at Cabon in 2009. They said, oh, yeah, this year, by the way, we changed the entire way we're going to do this bond issue. You need to pass a $120 million bond issue so we can finish
Welcome
the high
aboard.
School that we promised.
So, and he did it with flying colors.
I spent my first
colors.
Year. I talked to anyone that I could find on the street. Sometimes I just drive around at night and go talk to people to try to make sure I was connected with the community before that election. But, no, we had a great turnout, and it's the right thing to do. It's going to be a big change, but it would have been – a much longer big change in the old model. It would have been existing yeah. for 3 to 4 years, at least this way. Once we get the decisions made and we mm-hmm. start notifying parents, we know what we need to do. And I have a firm belief that once we get it going, everyone's going to love the school they go to. Every kid loves the school they go to. Well, not every kid, but most kids. Even when I was in a previous district, we had a school that was falling apart, and we had to close that school down just because it wasn't safe. And the kids loved that school. They didn't love that school. They loved the teachers. And we closed that school because it wasn't safe and other political reasons. We shipped all those kids to another elementary school. We redistributed the teachers. We did not have one complaint the next year because our schools are popular because of the relationships between adults and kids. That's what a school is. It's not a building.
I have to add, too,
that building be gorgeous.
Yes, it will be.
We like good facilities, no question about it. You know, I have to say that Columbia Public Schools has a great tradition of being accountable and responsible for the bond and tax levy issues that it's passed over you know, 150 years or however long the district has been around. And I think that it's important to note that as we move into the next year and continue to look at the needs of the community and the school district. I think sometimes people forget that when a bond issue passes, it doesn't mean that the very next year there's going to be a building in place and it's going to be all done and we can check it off the list. But it takes years to phase those things in. And, you know, we're still phasing in some of the 2010 bond and some of the 2007 bond. And that's just the way it works. But the school district is still checking off their list and getting all the things done that they said that they were going to do through those past bond issues and through the tax levies. And I think that that's something that we can all be proud of as taxpayers and as parents in this district.
Okay. I want to jump in at this point and remind everyone that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA, the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about new school boundary lines in Columbia. And joining me in the studio are Superintendent Chris Belcher, school board member Jan Mies, and co-chair of the committee working on the boundary proposals, Darren Priest. For those of you in our audience, do you have questions or comments about the school system in Columbia? If so, here is your chance to talk with our panelists. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We did get an email from one of our audience members. Linda wrote in to say, I want to thank all of our guests for an excellent job working on this time-consuming and sometimes thankless job. This writer says, our school system did this process in 1973 when Rockbridge High School opened, and we survived it then. As one of the original faculty members at Rockbridge, I know we can survive and thrive this time as well. That's from Linda, one of our audience members.
Thank you, Linda.
Yay, Linda. You may be a Linda I know. I don't know.
Darren was talking about bond issues and tax levy increases, and that sort of brings us to other things you were going to be talking about at the school board meeting tonight,
yes.
Both of those things, a tax levy and a bond issue. And I wonder if you could give our audience a little bit of explanation of what that's all about. I mean,
let me jump in first.
Go for this.
We know that there's probably no worse time to try to get a tax increase with a long recession we're in. But there's two things that were very clear to me when I came here. And one was our facilities were way behind. The high school and the reorganization of the secondary is going to take care of a lot of that. And when we get that fully phased in, we will get rid of 50 trailers. We'll still have 100 trailers left in our elementary schools. The average age of those trailers is 16 years old. They're starting to fail. They're energy inefficient. They don't have bathrooms. We don't have adequate restroom space, cafeteria space at a lot of schools that have too many trailers because the schools were designed for the bricks and mortar. So one of the challenges we had from our World Cafe was the community said we want to be rid of trailers. Can you give us a plan? And we've come up with a very good 10-year plan. It's going to cost a little bit of money, 12 cents this April, 8 cents the 2 Aprils after that. But after that, we can start having a 2-year no-tax increase cycle, and we can get our facilities up to the grade of facilities that Columbia deserves. We're way behind. This is not normal in schools to have this many trailers. And it will save energy costs. There's all sorts of good things. So we've got that plan for the public to consider, and the board will act on it tonight. The levy is a separate issue. I came in and the economy was starting to tank. We were losing local assessed valuation increases. We weren't losing money. We were just losing the normal increase. And then the state budget was being supported by federal stimulus dollars. We have done our job. We have cut $20 million in 4 years. And of that $20 million, we saved $10 million in balances. Knowing that this next year is going to be a funding cliff, that when the federal stimulus dollars were gone, we would have to be prepared to deficit spend and have some money saved up to do that in order to ride out the storm. Well, the storm doesn't look like it's going to be as short as we had hoped it was going to be, and the state legislature has not shown any inclination to look at revenue enhancement, and therefore we know we will experience or continue to experience radical decreases in state funding. And so a 40-cent levy is being placed in front of the voters, should the board act on it tonight, to say, we need this just to maintain the quality we have. We're not adding back a lot of things. We'll reduce some class sizes and we'll do some things with technology. But really, if the state economy continues to slump and we do not get new revenue from the state, failure to do any action locally will result in us having to dismantle some very important programs in Columbia Public Schools that make us special, and we think that's a public decision because it's a public school.
Right, and the Missourian is reporting that would raise the property tax assessment up to $4.48 per $100 of assessed valuation on a property. So that's what
the,
you the said,
total,
40 cents per
The
per
total combined, the 40
right?
and the 12, the 52 cents is $12.34 for the median family home, which is about $150,000.
Per month is what they're paying.
Right.
What about the bond proposal? There's a $50 million bond proposal as well that's going to be
that's
talked
12
about.
That's 12
cents. 12 cents. And that will build another elementary school. It will build an early childhood center on the Lang Middle School property, and I'll explain that. We have about 27 classrooms in our school district that are preschool classrooms. If we build a preschool center, we can remove those out of the current elementary schools and therefore increase the capacity in our current elementary schools by about 400 students. We can build an early childhood center for about $8 million, or about half the cost of a full elementary school, because you don't need the same upgrades of facilities. So that's a really smart thing to do. If we want to continue to do preschool, which I think we do, I'm a firm believer that early intervention is a key, but we can consolidate that in the central area, give collaboration time for those employees for a specialized student population, and increase the capacity in our current elementary schools by 400. So really, with building an elementary school and building an early childhood center, it's like adding two elementary schools in capacity. Mm-hmm. We would also add on to Shepherd Elementary School and West Boulevard Elementary School to such a degree that we can get rid of the trailers there. So if all goes as planned for this 10-year plan, by 2018 we'd be on our way to being trailer-free in this community. Mm-hmm. And along with that comes lots of other benefits, and certainly we don't have time to go into that. But we feel it's just honest to put this in front of the voters. And if they say no, then you know what? We live with trailers.
Right. And that early childhood center, is that something that would be totally new location, new construction, everything? Or is that something that would be on an existing site?
It's on land that we already own at Lang Middle School.
Mm-hmm.
So
we've got a large lot at Lang, and the engineers and architects tell us there's plenty of room to put a standalone facility. And since they arrive and leave at different times, that it can withstand that issue. And we've got good in and out traffic flow in that area.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the prognosis for this is? I mean, the board's going to discuss it tonight. Where do you think this is?
My feeling as to how the board will, I feel the board will approve this wholeheartedly. We've been having discussions on budget issues and building issues in great depth since October. And so the board has been mulling this over for quite a long period of time and really realizes that the numbers show, is if it's population or if it's operations, we do need enhancement to our budget. Our taxpayers pay almost 60% of our total budget because we've lost funding from the states and the federals. And this asking them for more doesn't come to us lightly, but it comes to us with great information as to a very real need that we do have.
Right.
And let me add a few things. One, in the last 4 years, we've cut $20 million in budget, we've cut 260 staff members, and we've added 465 students. Yeah. So we just can't keep on that trajectory without going upside down. Right. So we have to do that. We also live in a state that has a legislature that's saying that they're not going to raise taxes, and they brag on that and get reelected on it. But in the reality, that eventually pushes down to the local level. And at this point, this year, the state of Missouri is 49th in state-supported funding for public education. That's K-12 and higher ed. 49th out of 51 counties in the District of Columbia. We're behind Arkansas in state funding of public schools. And if we continue to go this route, we could go down to number 50 or 51. We have the 49th lowest salary schedule for teachers in the nation. It's not like we're sitting on top of the rock and asking for more. We have been very judicious with our money in the Columbia Public Schools. Missouri has been very conservative and judicious with their dollars. So this is not asking on top of something that is already a lucrative model.
Yeah.
So,
not
so the question you're trying to ask is, will the community pass this?
Well, yeah. that was my next question. What do you think the voters are going to do here?
As
do
a
you
voter,
think they're going to support it?
Yes,
I'm
going to
say
for
the record right now that, yes, the community will pass both of these. I think that you know, an inordinate amount of the trust in any given school district is placed on the superintendent. And Dr. Belcher is a tireless advocate for this district. And I'm astounded how often I see him doing exactly what he's doing today and really justifying the decisions that the school board is being asked to make and providing good reasons and good justification and accountability for all of these actions. This is not smoke and mirrors. You know, there are naysayers in the community that will want to point to things that aren't real and aren't true. But the fact is that we have a phenomenal school district, a very strong community that supports education, supports the school district, and I think that they're going to support this whole concept.
Right. And our board is not a rubber stamp board by any stretch of the imagination. And when we make a decision, it is based on true and accurate information. And I feel that we are not hiding anything as to the huge need that is evident in the community.
And I would think it would be safe if you would go to the Tribune Missouri and just do a search and type in, you will find a very good archive of the discussions that have been going on 18 months minimum on the levy. And longer than that on the facilities and the elementary schools and the trailers. It's been a very public discussion.
Mm-hmm. And if this stuff doesn't pass, then what would happen in that case?
Well, there's several things. Well, one, you always take it back to the board because I don't vote and I don't make a decision. But what we know would happen, if voters say no, it's sort of a slap in the face to turn around and ask them right again to say yes again. So you have to take some actions. And what would happen on the levy, we'd simply have to start reducing programs, freezing salaries, doing lots of things that will reduce our ability to deliver the program we can. And on the bond issue, it means living within what we have, which means schools are going to get more crowded because we continue to grow. Mm-hmm. If that's not going to change, we're a vibrant community compared to a lot of the other communities. Right. Our unemployment's 30% lower than everyone else's. We've got good housing, good schools. So we just have to do with a product that I don't think the community wants, because we know the number one drawing point when the university or the hospitals try to recruit someone is, what is your community like and what are your schools like? Mm-hmm. And everyone wants to have beautiful elementary schools that their child can walk to. They want class sizes that allow their child to have individual attention and relationships with the adult staff. They want that. And if they want that, that means our community becomes more vibrant and our housing values stabilize and grow, which they have compared to others. I would add that Columbia has looked at a 2% reduction in home values. Looking at St. Louis and Kansas City areas, it's 15 to 20% reduction in some places. It's all an integral, very complex social order, and we all play our role, and the schools trying their best to play the role of the steward of education.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're going to have to stop there. I'm sorry, Darren. We are out of time today. We'll try to get another hour at some point. We do this every week. So I'd like to thank our guests, Superintendent Chris Belcher, School Board Member Jan Meese, and co-chair of the committee working on the boundary proposals, Darren Priest. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour every Monday at 2. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar and Janet Saidi. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Karen Clifford. Pat Akers is our audio producer. I'm Ruben Stern. I'd like to thank you for joining us. Have a great week.